So it is a significant day for Arlene Foster, one of the biggest days in her political career, as she sits in front of the RHI inquiry, who will question her further about her role in the RHI scheme. We'll hear the DUP leader being questioned about what she knew about the role of her former special advisor, Andrew Crawford, and allegations that he delayed cost controls on the order of the party. One of the interviews that Arlene Foster will be asked about is an interview I did, the BBC did, with Arlene Foster in 2016 about those delays to the RHI scheme's cost controls.
There seems to have been delay after delay. If you think about it, they want the scheme changed in September. They then want the scheme changed in October. They then want the scheme changed in November.
No, the submission that was signed by Jonathan in September stated that the scheme was to close in November.
No, there was a period of October where they wanted it changed as well, 1st of October.
No, the submission that he signed off in September said November.
1st of October was also a point that they aimed for, First Minister.
Yes, but what he signed off...
It is yes.
No, what he signed off on the 4th of September was that the scheme would close in November.
What I'm asking you is, do you know why there were these delays then?
I have no idea.
You haven't asked?
No, that's a matter for John. And why would I ask? I was Finance Minister at the time.
Why would you ask?
Yeah.
You're the First Minister of our country. This is a scheme which has cost
hundreds of millions. Yes, a scheme which Jonathan kept
pounds,
open for a period of weeks.
And you still haven't asked what the delay is.
No, because
about.
Jonathan hasn't spoken to me for a long period of time.
I'm talking about you asking on behalf of the public.
Yes, well, perhaps I'm sure he'll tell you why he delayed the scheme and left it open for a period of time. It would be very interesting to hear, because I am bemused as to why he would leave it open for such a period of time.
So let me get this right. We are hearing now of people who have been putting boilers into sheds and blasting heat into the sky. We know that these delays were a factor. And as our First Minister, you still haven't asked what the delays were about. You still haven't briefed yourself.
Because Jonathan signed off on a submission on the 4th of September.
Do you not want to know?
Well, I'm sure you've asked him the reason why he has left the scheme open for that period of time. I'd be very interested to hear why he has said that, because of course there was no influence from the former First Minister. There was no influence from me as Finance Minister. How could I have an influence, because I was at the same level as Jonathan? He took the decision to leave it open for that period of time.
Now, the newsletter's political editor Sam McBride with us this morning. So Sam, Arlene Foster in that interview, December 2016, saying she had no idea why the scheme had been left open. And we know that others have testified to the inquiry that there was a briefing days before that interview.
That's right. I think that this is potentially one of the most significant areas of questioning which Arlene Foster is going to be subjected to today. This is something which she has been asked about in her written evidence, which was published by the inquiry last night. And in that, she says that she is asked about various pieces of evidence which have been put to the inquiry, which suggest that she should have known, or she did know, that Andrew Crawford was the person who was alleged, that's Andrew Crawford, her former special advisor, is the person who was alleged to have been acting to delay cost controls. He denies that, but the allegation, we are told, was either put to her personally or was put to her very close advisors who were briefing her for the interview with you. She's asked about that, and she says in her written evidence to the inquiry, Andrew McCormick, that's the senior civil servant, had not told me this, and I did have no idea. Now, that's in relation to her answer to you, where she was asked very pointedly what did she know about the delay to cost controls? Why were they delayed? And she said she had no idea, and that seemed to be a very conclusive question, or a very conclusive answer. And then she went on, as you heard there, to say that she hadn't even asked about the issue. Now, that is something which both Timothy Kearns, who was the then special advisor to Jonathan Bell, the minister who was responsible for the scheme, he has said that on a conference call the day before that interview, he did talk about this issue. He talked about it on a call with a DUP special advisor who put him onto speakerphone in Stormont Castle. Mrs. Foster identified herself as being in the room, and they discussed this. Now, that is something which she is going to be asked about in great detail today, and potentially is one of, I think, the most significant areas of questioning for her in this phase of the inquiry.
Because I think what's important here is we've got to remember that this isn't about what she did or didn't say to me in that interview. The whole purpose, clearly, of any interview is that she's talking to the public. So what she was doing was she was saying in that BBC interview to the public of Northern Ireland that she had no idea why those cost controls were delayed. Now, as you say, Sam, I think it's important for people to know this. That is in absolute categoric conflict with Timothy Cairns, who was one of the special advisors at the time, who says that Arlene Foster, and I'm going over this deliberately, Sam, so we get this in our minds, because it is going to be one of the things discussed at the RHI inquiry today. So Timothy Cairns, a DUP special advisor at the time, says that there was a conference call the day before Arlene Foster told me she had no idea. She says that Timothy Cairns says that Richard Bullock, Timothy Johnson, Arlene Foster and himself were on a conference call and they discussed the cost controls being delayed. So both statements cannot be true, Sam.
That's right. And we've got a degree of evidence to back up Timothy Cairns' claim, albeit it's not entirely conclusive at this stage. But the inquiry has used its extensive powers to compel phone records. It has compelled the phone records of Timothy Cairns. And those records show that he had a phone call with Richard Bullock. That's who he says that he phoned, who put him onto speakerphone in Stormont Castle. Richard Bullock was one of Mrs. Foster's key advisors at that point. And he says that that was the moment where he told her about this. He says the conversation was very quickly shut down at that point. But the phone records show that there was a call that it lasted for 19 minutes. We don't yet know what the other people on that call will say about what happened in it, but we do know that there was a phone call to Mrs. Foster's closest advisor. And then the second aspect of this, where it's not quite as clear-cut where somebody is saying they told her to her face, if you like, but whether they are saying that they told somebody who ought to have told her, that is Andrew McCormick, the senior civil servant, who says that he was in regular discussions with her closest advisors over the days leading up to this interview and on the day of the interview discussing this issue. Now, he clearly, from his evidence to the inquiry, sounded surprised at the idea that in a situation where she was facing a very difficult interview, she would not be fully prepared for it, she would not be fully briefed on everything that she needed to know so that she didn't stumble into saying something that was inaccurate or wrong or which created a difficulty further down the line. But he does say that he can't prove that she was told because all he can say is, I told those closest to the First Minister.
Let's come back to the phone call. Richard Bullock is said to have been part of that conference call as well. Now, Richard Bullock was a senior advisor to the DUP. He was at the very top of advising the DUP. He's no longer with them. What is he saying about this conference call? Timothy Cairns claims that Mr. Bullock was on that call. Does Richard Bullock confirm Timothy Cairns' version of events or Arlene Foster's version of events?
Well, Richard Bullock has three witness statements to the inquiry, which were published last night. The fact, just to explain the context of this, the fact that those witness statements were published last night, but he has not been called as a witness today, suggests to me that he's not going to be called as a witness because generally the inquiry only publishes witness statements of the person who either is coming the following day or someone who is not going to be called. So it seems that we will not hear from him in person. But in those statements, it's not entirely clear to me exactly what he's saying about this issue. I think it's fair to say that he's not asked about it in the same level of detail as Mrs. Foster was asked about it, and she is really categorical. So there are two people apart from Mrs. Foster and Mr. Cairns who were on this call. There's Mr. Bullock and there's Timothy Johnston, who will be in front of the inquiry on Friday. So his evidence will be very important in this. But it's not entirely clear to me from the written statements what exactly Mr. Bullock is saying about it.
Like, obviously, the inquiry know a lot more about this than I do, Sam, but surely that's really important, to, if there are four people on the call, to ask all four of them what was said.
Well, it may well be that the inquiry, I mean, this is an iterative process, if you like. People are constantly being asked questions. There are follow-up questions, statements which are coming in really all the way through this inquiry process. So it's entirely possible that there will be more questions that will go to Mr. Bullock. It's also a case that there was an awful lot of material, hundreds of pages really published last night. I went through it quite quickly. It's possible that I have missed something there that I will find in more detail later today. But certainly the impression that I got from his statement was that it's not anywhere near as clear from his statement as it is in comparison to Mrs. Foster's statement as to just exactly what happened on that call.
I also asked Arlene Foster about the former DUP SPAD, Timothy Johnson's role in keeping the scheme open. Let's have a listen to how she answered the question.
And then there were delays in September 2015.
Well, it's my understanding, looking at the papers, that Jonathan was told in June that there were big difficulties with the scheme. He received a submission in early July. He did not sign that submission off until I think somewhere in early September. And in that submission in early September, he chose to close the scheme in November. So Jonathan took all of those decisions. No one from the Office of First and Deputy First Minister, as I understand it, having spoken not directly, but to understand from the former First Minister that nobody in that office intervened. I certainly didn't intervene because I was a finance minister at the time. What authority would I have had to intervene? Because I was at the same level as Jonathan, why would he have listened to me in relation to any of these issues?
He is saying, and this is a man who was a minister, your party appointed him as a minister, he is saying, that an official or officials from OFM, DFM and SPADs, special advisors,
I have no evidence for that. You have no evidence for that. This is Jonathan trying to distract from the fact, of course, that he took the decision in September after being sent the submission in July to close the scheme in November, thereby leaving a gap and thereby allowing a spike.
He named one of the special advisors, who you know well, as Timothy Johnson. And when we asked Mr. Johnson, did you ever attempt to influence any decision in relation to the RHI scheme, he replied, the role of advisors is to offer advice. I never sought to influence any decision. Yes. Did he advise to delay the tariff being delayed? The tariff being changed?
No, I understand that no one from the Office of First Minister and Deputy First Minister intervened in terms of the tariff change in September. What I do understand is that advisers, of course, will advise, but the minister takes the decision.
So did Timothy Johnson have any role in advising to keep that lucrative scheme open?
No.
And it's that answer, no, Sam McBride, which is an absolute conflict with what Timothy Kearns told the inquiry. He suggests that this phone call, this conference call that happened before that interview, part of that was him telling the people on that phone call, including Arlene Foster, that Timothy Johnson had intervened.
That's right. And there are two issues with Timothy Johnson, and it will be teased out in more detail when he's in front of the inquiry on Friday. But one of the questions which the inquiry is trying to get to the bottom of is, did he have the sort of power within Stormont as a special advisor where he was able to tell people what to do? So was he the kingpin SPAD in the DUP? Was he really at the top of the tree? As several witnesses, several senior witnesses who were working with him in that period have alleged. Other people have said that's not the case. And secondly, if he did have that power, did he use it to try to delay cost controls? And what you hear from Mrs. Foster there is responding to the second of those questions, saying he did not use that power to delay cost controls. But one of the interesting things which I think she will be asked about today is how did he operate? Did he have the sort of clout within Stormont that he was acting as a quasi-ministerial figure, as somebody who could give instructions almost, or they were interpreted as instructions to other DUP ministers and to other people in the DUP? Or was he just, as he says, a rank-and-file SPAD? They were all equal. There was no difference between them, and certainly he was not somebody who could ever have instructed Mr. Bell to have done anything. So there'll be a lot of focus on that issue.
Let me just come back, Sam, as well, to Andrew McCormick. He was the permanent secretary at the time, correct? Correct me if I'm wrong.
And he was the permanent secretary in the economy department, which was running the scheme.
Sure. And Andrew McCormick's testimony is that, as you've just told us a matter of minutes ago, his testimony is that he was briefing some of Arlene Foster's closest advisers days before she did that interview with me about his belief that Andrew Crawford, something that Mr. Crawford denies, that Andrew Crawford had sought to delay the cost controls, okay? So if we listen to that interview, the clip that we've just played from Arlene Foster, really carefully, she says that she knew because she had found out from Peter Robinson that he had not been involved. In fact, what I think we should do is just listen to this clip again. My point here, if we listen to this clip again, is that she's clearly been in touch and sought what Peter Robinson has done, and yet she doesn't seem to have heard anything from her special advisers about Andrew Crawford's alleged involvement. Let's have a listen.
And then there were delays in September 2015.
Well, it's my understanding, looking at the papers, that Jonathan was told in June that there were big difficulties with this scheme. He received a submission in early July. He did not sign that submission off until, I think, somewhere in early September. And in that submission in early September, he chose to close the scheme in November. So Jonathan took all of those decisions. No one from the Office of First and Deputy First Minister, as I understand it, having spoken, not directly, but to understand from the former First Minister, that nobody in that office intervened. I certainly didn't intervene because I was a Finance Minister at the time. What authority would I have had to intervene? Because I was at the same level as Jonathan, why would he have listened to me in relation to any of these issues?
He is saying, and this is a man who was a minister, your party appointed him as a minister, he is saying, that
so, Sam, my point there is that Arlene Foster is clearly demonstrating that she's gone out and she has sought clarity from whoever it was, that what Peter Robinson was or wasn't saying. She was across the dates of the scheme, and yet Andrew McCormick's evidence is that he told her advisors about Andrew Crawford's involvement, and yet that information, all of the other information, got to Arlene Foster, and that information didn't.
That's right, and really the picture which emerges from Mrs. Foster's statement that was published last night is very clear in this point. She says she was never told about this. She says that Andrew McCormick told her for the first time to her face on the night of the interview with you. She said that was immediately after the interview, but she says that she never knew it before that. And really, that suggests really that she is implying, I suppose, that her advisors were not doing their jobs properly, that they had all this information, they weren't sharing it with her. She was doing this major interview. Now, she doesn't spell that out, but that is, I think, what a reasonable person would take from that. And it's certainly what Dr. McCormick seems to have taken from that. He was very surprised when he heard the interview. We see that he texted the special advisors on the night of the broadcast as it was going out, saying, really querying with them why she was saying what she was saying. He really just couldn't believe that she was saying she had no idea when he was saying to them, I've been telling you this for days, this is my belief. Now, those advisors, and certainly Richard Bullock, say to the inquiry that they took the view that there was no evidence that Andrew Crawford had delayed cost controls, and therefore when it came to Mrs. Foster speaking about this issue a few days later to the Assembly, they were comfortable with her not mentioning that piece of knowledge that she did by that stage definitely have, because they said that Mr. Bullock says that he didn't think it was right that she was putting before the Assembly something that really was little more than hearsay, if you like, albeit hearsay from a very senior person within government. But at this point, it's very clear that Dr. McCormick felt that he had passed the information on to somebody who would have passed it on to Mrs. Foster, and perhaps that was why he had told them the information. And he was very surprised and perhaps even alarmed when he saw Mrs. Foster saying that's not really, she had no idea what had happened here.
Why does it matter, Sam? Let's boil this down. Why does it matter whether it is true or not when she says she had no idea?
Well, it's very simple. I suppose there are two issues here. First of all, was she entirely candid with the public? Did she tell us everything that she knew? Did she withhold pieces of information that might have been uncomfortable for the DUP? Was there some sort of DUP attempt to just dump all of this onto Jonathan Bell and say it was all his fault? And a very simple story. And secondly, in the terms of the inquiry, was Mrs. Foster more aware of what was going on here and at an earlier point than she has initially said? And that is obviously then significant as to her evidence to the inquiry and how that's going to be viewed. So we will see this teased out in great detail today, but I think that this is going to be one of the key areas of focus today, and certainly that there has been so much evidence to the inquiry from two very significant witnesses, Mr. Kearns and Dr. McCormick, and this today, and then Mr. Johnston's evidence on Friday will be very, very important, I think, to understanding what went on behind the scenes in this period.
And how crucial or critical is Arlene Foster's performance today at the inquiry to her standing as a politician in this country?
Well, I think it's fair to say that over the last couple of years, she has been greatly diminished in terms of her clout within the DUP. Her authority is certainly weakened. She obviously does not have any ministerial post at this point, so she is a leader without an office, if you like. So there's no question that she is coming into this entire process in a more difficult situation than she would have hoped to have been the case. But I think that given what the inquiry has already uncovered about the nature of how the DUP operated in Stormont, I think it has to be said, not just the DUP, Sinn Féin as well, but today it's a focus on that Mrs. Foster. I think there are very, very uncomfortable questions that are going to be coming her way, and how she answers those will be very, very significant, not just for the inquiry process, but also for the political confidence of her party colleagues. Some of her party colleagues, many of her party colleagues will be watching this very closely today. Some of them are concerned about what might come out this week. And I think there will be a lot riding on this, not just in the inquiry process where they're asking questions, trying to get to the truth of what happened here, but also in politics. This is very significant for who's going to lead the DUP and potentially who's going to lead Northern Ireland if Stormont comes back.
Yeah, so I've been told by a number of senior people this week within the DUP that this week will define the party.
Well, I think that certainly over the last 3 or 4 weeks, there has been a sense among some people in the DUP that this is a pretty definitive point, that there is an exposure, I suppose, of how the culture of the party operated in this period. This is a period which lasted for over 10 years during devolution. And really, it was a very closed, tightly disciplined situation where we didn't get to see very much of this stuff. And what we're getting from the inquiry is really the unvarnished picture of what was going on. And just as one example of how uncomfortable this is for the DUP and how illuminating it is for us who are on the outside looking in, we have text messages published last night between senior DUP figures, some of them involved Nigel Dodd, Simon Hamilton, Timothy Johnston, Richard Bullock, but a very interesting exchange between John Robinson, who will be up in front of the inquiry tomorrow, who is now the DUP's chief spin doctor. He was a special advisor at that point, and some of his other party colleagues, where he is clearly furious at a party colleague, Clive McFarland, who is now the DUP press officer working under him, for releasing Mrs. Foster's letter to the banks, where she had effectively given what was a personal cast-iron guarantee that this is a scheme which will not be altered. It's a reliable long-term guarantee, and it really tied her much more closely to this than the perception that she was presenting to the public, that really it was all the civil servants' fault and she had very little to do with it. And he was very unhappy at this, and he really used some quite colourful language suggesting that Mr. McFarland must have been on the drink when he sent this out. And you really get a sense, I suppose,
something no doubt that Mr. McFarland would deny.
I'm sure he would, and I mean, I've got no reason to believe that that's actually true, but you get a sense of how desperate things were at the top of the party around Christmas 2016, how they were desperately trying, I suppose, to get their story straight, trying to get this story off the front pages, off your programme, and they failed.
And Sam, again, the culture, and I don't know, maybe this happens within every organisation, but if they're saying that about themselves, so Clive McFarland is now a DUP, I haven't spoken to Clive in the last couple of months because the DUP don't speak to us. But Clive McFarland's a DUP press officer. If the likes of John Robinson is behind that man's back saying that about him, what on earth is the culture within the DUP? We've got these conflicting statements now where one person says black, the other says white. And now we have John Robinson, who was a very senior press officer. He's basically accusing one of his colleagues of being on the drink and inappropriately releasing this letter. What's
That's
the
right,
culture and I think- within that party, which was trying to run Northern Ireland?
Well, certainly from the evidence which we have seen, at points it was a pretty aggressive, pretty full throttle approach to politics. I think that what we get here is something which pricks the fiction, if you like, that the DUP was one big happy family. Everyone was rowing in the same direction. Everyone was committed to the high political ideals which the party espoused. That's certainly the image which Ian Paisley, Peter Robinson and Arlene Foster presented to the public, that their party wasn't like other parties. It was a very different beast. It was something where people cared about each other. They loved each other. It was a family atmosphere. What we see here is that this was it was politics at its rawest. It was politics at its most bloody, if you like, in that some cases they were really operating in a way which would not have been that alien in various points to Alistair Campbell or people who were around Tony Blair at the point where special advisers wielded huge power there. And I think that is one of the issues which, to some people in the DUP, they were always uncomfortable with. It brought the party great success in some ways, but now I think they're looking at it and in some cases questioning, actually, did we go too far and is this now a hindrance to the party going forward?
Yeah, Simon Hamilton, I'm looking at some of the text exchanges that there were. Simon Hamilton wrote on, the 30th of December 2016, so just after Christmas, the bank letter that you just talked about, the one that, of course, Arlene Foster had written. Simon Hamilton writes, "These bank letters are a bollocks. Like other things, nothing in them, but it's the fact it gives all legs again." Simon Hamilton, Bryson was tweeting some SHITE last night about senior party meetings yesterday, and so it goes on.
That's right. And what you get here, I mean, somebody picked up on this last night, that really there is more evidence in some ways coming to the inquiry from some of these text messages between DUP special advisers, which the inquiry has compelled them to release. Then we do have details in minutes at Stormont about what was going on in some of these periods. So whether this was a conscious attempt to do party business, to do government business off the system on private email accounts or on text messages or WhatsApp or whatever, trying to keep it away from things, or whether this was just an innocent exchange which was not intended to hide this from departmental officials or from Freedom of Information requests, it's not entirely clear. But what we do get here is a really insightful picture into how these people operated away from the cameras. Perhaps it's not any great shock that people use more colourful language, more blunt language when they're speaking in private than when they're speaking in public. But it certainly, I think, does make it more difficult for the party to present some of the public image that it sought to present of a happy family, of a very Christian party, of a party where everybody was really enthusiastic about the project and committed to it. I think what we see here is people really scrambling around trying to kill the story if they possibly can.
Sam, finally, Sinn Féin also under scrutiny. I'm looking at the headline that your paper has put on this part of the story. Email shows a Mueller wanted RHI scheme kept open.
That's right. This is a very interesting piece of evidence. It is something which, again, questions just how candid Sinn Féin were with the public at the height of this scandal. Michelle O'Neill came out in January 2017 after Stormont had collapsed, and she said that really her party had moved to shut it down straight away when her party was told about how big the overspend was, what the difficulties were. This shows that far from shutting it down straight away, Máirtín O'Meara, who was obviously the South Belfast MLA, who would go on to be the finance minister and have a certain responsibility for trying to clear up this mess, was actually somebody who at that point in February 2016, where there were attempts to close the scheme quickly, he was arguing for a delay to closure. He was saying to somebody who was hoping to get onto the scheme before the deadline that he hoped that she would be able to do that. He hoped that other people would be able to do that and that really they could delay as long as would be possible. And really, the picture here again is of a party which is not being candid with the public, which is saying one thing privately to people who want to get a boiler in, and are saying a very different thing when they're speaking to taxpayers who are very angry about the fact that their money went into this scheme. Now, it is very important to stress that at this point there were cost controls in the scheme. It was not cash for ash. It was a different situation to 2015, but nevertheless there was a very significant exposure to taxpayers from this delay to closure, and it is clear from this that certainly some senior people in Sinn Féin were acting to try to delay closure. They were taking credit for it with the people who they thought would like that. And then when things became much more public and there was a lot of anger around this, Michelle O'Neill presented a rather different picture to the public.
And finally, Sam, there's so much in this story. My goodness, we could just run The Nolan Show every single day of the week. The former editor of The Nolan Show, David Gordon, who went up to then be a senior Stormont official, he was in the news recently because there was testimony that he had compared the... This is David Gordon. He had compared the DUP minister, Jonathan Bell, to the monster created by Dr. Frankenstein. He has submitted further copy to the inquiry, insisting he was not briefing against the minister in relation to his role in the RHI scandal. Now, David Gordon was the executive press secretary at the time, and an email was uncovered in which the inquiry found that Mr. Gordon had suggested that Peter Robinson was referred to as Frankenstein, and Mr. Gordon had suggested that Frankenstein put his monster to sleep. That was Jonathan Bell. What David Gordon has submitted to the inquiry is that this was a metaphor or a joke which has been misinterpreted. He says clearly an attempt at humour in a private email does not remotely constitute evidence of briefing against Mr. Bell. He says, I was not suggesting, like, you couldn't make some of this stuff up, Sam. Here's what David Gordon, here's what David Gordon has told Sir Patrick Coughlan and the inquiry. Quote, I was not suggesting that Mr. Robinson had fathered Mr. Bell or created him in a lab. Nor was I proposing that the former First Minister or anyone else should actually put him to sleep. Similarly, I was not claiming or briefing that Mr. Bell was actually a monster.
It's certainly difficult to keep a straight face. When
I'm
you're
trying
reading
to. Like, I really am trying to.
I mean, I think this might seem like quite a flippant issue. It might seem not that terribly important in the grand scheme of things. I think actually this is quite significant because what we have here is a question about how Jonathan Bell interprets evidence, how across the detail he is, how capable he is of looking at something and working out what's actually going on, or whether he gets the wrong end of the stick. And what Mr. Bell presented to the inquiry was that he had seen this evidence in the inquiry bundle. He had never obviously had access to it beforehand, so it wasn't something he was bringing to the table, if you like. But he had seen it, we hadn't seen it, and he presented his version of it, if you like, to the public before we got to see the actual document itself. And what we have here from Mr. Gordon is a suggestion that really this was a private email to Richard Bullock, a DUP special advisor. It was pretty candid. It was quite colourful, but there was no way that it was a briefing to the media. It was a private email to a DUP special advisor. It was very internal, and it was actually raising quite significant questions, a very significant political question about where was Peter Robinson in all of this? Why was he not coming out more forcefully around this issue? But Mr. Bell didn't pick up on that, it would seem, if Mr. Gordon's view of this is correct. Mr. Bell immediately saw this as an attack on him. He saw this as something that was an attempt to get at him, that you had the whole machinery of government, as he saw it, arrayed against him. And he had talked about himself as a boy who was standing up against the huge civil service machine. I think that's actually quite interesting in interpreting how he looks at evidence, how he interprets it. And really then the inquiry, I think, will look at that in terms of some of the other things which he has looked at and how he's interpreted them, and particularly how he interpreted some of the documents that were shown to him by Andrew McCormick before he did his big interview with you.
I would pay millions of pounds to be able to see Dame Una, who sits on that panel, to be able to see her face, or indeed Keith McLean, who's one of the other panellists. I've never seen him with his two legs on the ground. That man has had his legs crossed for the whole inquiry. I would love to see their faces when they read this testimony from David Gordon. I was not suggesting that Mr. Robinson had fathered Mr. Bell or created him in a lab. This is the stuff of a movie. But it's very, very important, and we shouldn't forget that, because hundreds of millions of pounds were at stake here. Sam, thank you very much. Big, big day at the RHI inquiry. Thank you for your coverage, Sam, this morning. And Arlene Foster is due to sit in front of that inquiry in 5 minutes' time. A massive day for her political career. Let's see what comes out of it. And, of course, we'll keep you across it.